From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a huge tornado in Oklahoma. The president speaks on national security. The Boy Scouts of America vote to admit gay scouts. In Oklahoma, an EF5 tornado leveled block after block and took 24 lives. Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon spoke to the monstrous twister's stunning scale.
The tornado itself was very, very wide. It just wiped out miles of areas and homes and businesses. It's probably the worst I've ever seen.
In a big speech on counterterrorism, the president said the war on terror phase must end.
Our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue. But this war, like all wars, must end.
And the Boy Scouts of America voted to admit gay boys. Scouts CEO Wayne Brock said everyone should benefit from scouting.
I believe this resolution is truly in the best interest of scouting, and it allows us to serve youth who sincerely want to be a part of scouting and experience the life-changing benefits of our program.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with CBS's Major Garrett, CQ Roll Call's Meredith Shiner, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation never ends. Are you ready to make the war on terror something else? Did the scouts get it right? What about Apple, the IRS, that horrible knifing in London? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us now from Washington is Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News, Correspondent at Large with National Journal. Major Garrett, welcome back to On Point.
Tom, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Meredith Shiner, Staff Writer for CQ Roll Call. Meredith, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom, and hi to Major and Jack, for that matter.
Yes, and Jack in Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack. Great to have you here.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Meredith.
I guess we have to go first to the twister. I mean, twister seems like the wrong word. This was so wide and so deep, you couldn't even see the funnel. It was monstrous to look at. Its impact was monstrous. Here's a little sound. We've heard it all week long, but it bears hearing again. Oklahoma resident Jerry Gravett saw it bearing down on his home, talked with CBS on Tuesday.
And it hit big, and when it did, it just destroyed everything. My house, the roof was gone. The house across the street from me, the roof was gone. And then look back to the right, look back to the left, and the houses was all gone. Everything was pretty much just almost leveled down.
Jack Beatty, I don't know if it's the media or Mother Nature. I don't know what exactly is going on, but it seems in some way we live from natural disaster to natural disaster lately. They are the pillars of our news flow lately.
It seems that way. We stagger one to the other. And the question is, can anything be done about it? And kudos to Juliet Kayyem, the columnist for the Boston Globe, who thought it through, I think, very well in a column yesterday, pointing out that since 2011, there have been storms that have cost 1,000 fatalities and almost $200 billion. The question is, could that money have been better spent? Could the federal government somehow condition its aid to the states as block grants or siphon some of the aid that is sent to relieve people to build better and more resilient structures to help them the next time? Is there some way of using, instead of thinking disaster relief as something that makes everybody whole after the disaster and preps them for the next disaster, is there some way of if not preventing the next disaster, mitigating its harm through this transfer of funds?
Relief aid on the backside, or try to harden up in advance? But it's hard to picture what that would mean nationally. I mean, it's a big country. Things like this can hit anywhere. I don't know, Meredith. Sometimes I feel like we're all in sort of we get into this end times routine where you see that giant tornado, you think Godzilla, you think disaster, and we just go in this rhythm from one to the next. I do wonder about the politics of it, though, Meredith. We had the Moore, Oklahoma mayor, Glenn Lewis, come out and say the city council there ought to mandate that new homes built there be built with storm shelters. And then, we have this constant back and forth in this country. His own city manager, Steve Eddy, came right back. This was NPR on Thursday, saying, hey, we don't want to tell people necessarily what to do. Here he is.
We've had this discussion after every tornado that comes along and haven't done it yet. We're pretty independent lot around here in terms of telling me what I have to do and what I don't have to do. Home builders, we have lots and lots of homes built here. Home builders are influential.
Meredith, you know, there's this debate. How much do you spend in advance? How much do you spend after? How much do you spend, period? There was talk, I think, from Oklahoma representatives this week that whatever spent on rebuilding there should be taken out of the federal budget somewhere else in the country.
Well, yeah, so this is an argument that we've been having, I think, mostly for the past 2 years about how you might offset disaster aid. For background, we have approximately, I believe, $11 billion left in the general fund that we've set up for this disaster aid relief. But I think Jack was making a really interesting point. I was reading somewhere about this town in Oklahoma, how a lot of these homes didn't have basements. And the foundations weren't as sturdy as they could have been. And so obviously you can't prevent a gigantic tornado from ravaging the Midwest. But if you are going to prevent or present some sort of federal aid or state aid to rebuild these homes, then maybe there should be some stipulations on how you build those homes. But to your point about the policy fight over how we pay for this aid, I think one of the most interesting cases was Tom Cole, who is a representative from Oklahoma. And he was one of only two Oklahoma representatives, actually, or members of the Oklahoma delegation, including senators, I'm sorry, that voted for Sandy relief. And the two senators from Oklahoma did not. And the two senators from Oklahoma, Tom Coburn and Jim Inhofe, had said, if we have to pass an additional supplemental bill to provide more aid to Oklahoma, then we should find places to cut spending in the federal budget elsewhere. And it's become this very charged debate because it's something that happens immediately and questions that we ask immediately in Washington, because those are the stories that we cover, these spending bills and how the aid gets dispersed. But at the same time, you are seeing these images on the television where people are still being pulled from the rubble and buildings have collapsed. And so it's a delicate conversation, but it's one that needs to happen because it's not just about tornadoes in Oklahoma. It's about hurricanes in the southeast or even superstorms in the northeast. So these are something that ends up affecting most members of Congress. But sometimes it comes back to bite them. If you have a member of the Oklahoma delegation who did not vote for Sandy relief, who's now going to potentially ask for relief for their state, then you might have these representatives in the northeast say, well, where were you?
Yeah.
5 months ago when we were trying
when
to
when it all hit the fan here.
Yeah.
I mean, Major, it's left me thinking about the poetics of disaster, the way we're drawn to them, even though, I mean, they're also drawn to us. They're coming right into our face here. And the politics side by side. The media goes to this in such a big way. I guess they should. This is a big disaster. At the same time, the politics have a tough time coming to terms with the costs of one after another disaster.
Yes. Let me try to apportion this as best I can, Tom. I started my career at age 22 as a cop reporter in Amarillo, Texas, on the outer fringes of what is known as Tornado Alley that runs from West Texas through Oklahoma, through Kansas, and the southern part of Missouri. I went to the University of Missouri. I feel very deeply for the people who suffered in Joplin, Missouri, who suffered more than 100 casualties, more than 100 dead. I believe the number was 129.
2 years ago.
Yes, 2 years ago, and then Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I feel very deeply for those communities, which were ravaged in not only material terms, but in the terms of loss of life. And there are 24 people who died in Moore, Oklahoma, and those families really are not interested in the political debate in Washington about retrofitting or rebuilding or FEMA allocations. Their loss is pronounced. President Obama will be there on Sunday to in some way reflect the national mood about that loss. So that's one part of it. There's a climate change element to all of this that I believe at some point will filter through the political process, which is, should we take recognition of the climate signals that perhaps are being sent to us by what appear to be, in number and severity, greater and more catastrophic storms? That's one component of this. Then you have this debate about insurance companies, which are profit-driven and insure. Tom Coburn, the senator from Oklahoma, gave a briefing this week where he said, ultimately, he thinks the FEMA allocation in Oklahoma for this tornado will be less than $200 million because most businesses and homes were insured. Do you require homes in Tornado Alley to have straps on their roofs and straps to their foundation? Mm-hmm. If you do, people who have researched both what happened in Tuscaloosa and Joplin say you can drastically reduce the material damage, even of an EF5 storm like this one. You can't erase it, obviously, but there are things you can do that are within the cost parameters of most middle-class families and insurers to do these. These are all policy things going forward, but I think in the main, you have a band of destruction that is eye-popping and awe-inspiring in the worst sort of way, loss of life, presidential intervention, and a lot of underlying politics.
You know, I have to say I've been very impressed with Oklahomans stepping up and speaking up this week. Well-spoken people chipping in like crazy. You see the lines of volunteers just down the road coming in to help out. Jack, give us a little perspective here. I mean, you feel this rhythm of reports on major disasters. Does it feel different to you? Does the nature feel different, or does the nature of media feel different, Jack?
Well, picking up on the nature point, it is telling, isn't it, that just a week ago the headlines were saying that the climate is now as warm as it's been in, what was it, 10 million years or 4 million years? And I heard someone say, well, this was a 4 million year storm. Well, my gosh, is that the correlation? I just do think more and more that is the key thing, that nature does seem to be changing. Now, you get people who get into the theology of this, and they say, well, on the one hand and on the other hand, but dominantly, that's the impression one has, and you have to subtract from that the media glare. And if that's the case, then we have to think of resilience in an entirely different way.
I think that fear that something bigger is changing may be in part behind the media fascination. You look at it and say, oh my gosh, is this part of something bigger? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. Oklahoma's big tornado, the Boy Scouts vote on gay membership, the president on national security, drone strikes, Apple, the IRS. In the hot seat, Meredith Shiner is with us from CQ Roll Call. She also writes the WGDB blog following politics in the Senate. Major Garrett is here, chief White House correspondent for CBS News. Jack Beatty's here. A big, long speech from the president yesterday on national security, on counterterrorism. The message, kind of at the heart of it, is that the global war on terror cannot go on. He did not end it, but he said it cannot go on. Let's listen to a little bits of the speech right here.
Beyond Afghanistan, we must define our effort not as a boundless global war on terror, but rather as a series of persistent, targeted efforts to dismantle specific networks of violent extremists that threaten America.
Let's get specific, said the president. The country is at a crossroads.
From our use of drones to the detention of terrorist suspects, the decisions that we are making now will define the type of nation and world that we leave to our children. So America's at a crossroads. We must define the nature and scope of this struggle, or else it will define us.
And the war on terror, he said, must end.
Our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue. But this war, like all wars, must end. That's what history advises. It's what our democracy demands.
This war must end. But he did not, Major Garrett, say, and I'm ending it. So what did you take from the president's big, densely reasoned speech yesterday?
Look, first of all, Tom, I recommend it to everyone in America who is a serious thinker or seriously curious about the next stage of the U.S. effort and from a counterterrorism perspective to deal with a terrorist threat. It's a very important speech. And I believe history will record it as such many years from now, because it's not the definitive end of the war on terror, but it is a rhetorical end to the Bush and Obama era of the war on terror as defined by, first, engagement in Afghanistan and Pakistan, accelerated use of drones by President Bush, dramatically enlarged and more aggressive use of drones, unmanned aerial vehicles by President Obama, Guantanamo Bay, our legal architecture around capturing and questioning terrorist suspects, all of that now is in a completely different light as a result of this speech. Mm-hmm. And the one thing the president did not do is sort of take responsibility for his own actions as commander-in-chief. Look, this president ordered a vast expansion of the use of unmanned aerial vehicles to shoot and kill suspected terrorists. And he did that in Pakistan to the great consternation of not only the Pakistani government, but the Pakistani people. Okay?
He spent a lot of time explaining why he did that, Major.
Yes, he did. He said these were terrorist operatives, they were planning and plotting, and they deserved to be killed. That is the commander-in-chief's prerogative, and under the authorization of use of military force in both Pakistan and Afghanistan, within the broad parameters of the legal options for a commander-in-chief. But it doesn't mean it doesn't have consequences. Lots of civilians have died unintentionally as a result of these drone strikes. Sovereignty has been encroached in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. There have been other consequences from this particular approach to the war on terrorism. The drone strikes in number, severity, have declined in the last year. So the president's policy articulated in the speech was already being run through the last year when drone strikes were being used less frequently. Mm. And the president, after 5 years since he promised to close Guantanamo Bay, now revisits this issue. And I know from the senior most people in the White House who advised the president on this speech is now regarded in the White House as a turnstile, meaning the president cannot go back through this turnstile. He's walked through a watershed moment, if I can mix metaphors, and tried to begin engage Congress in how to close Guantanamo, how to deal with those inmates who were there, many of whom were on hunger strikes, many of whom who can't be tried in civilian courts, and quite probably in military tribunals because the evidence against them is either Spartan or not prosecutable. How do you deal with that? And to revisit and redraft the authorization of military force originally inspired by the 9/11 attacks and related specifically to Afghanistan and Pakistan. All of these things, now the president said in that speech, must be revisited. I guarantee you, Tom, the White House views this as a 3-year project for this president, but specifically and more importantly, for his successor.
You could see it as a historical speech, laying down a marker, laying down a deeply considered perspective on this. But, Jack, at the same time, I still wonder about the turnstile. Major says this president has walked through a turnstile. But did he really cut himself off from anything yesterday? He didn't cut himself off from using drones. In fact, he spent a lot of time justifying their use, saying when we don't have a local government to police and we don't have any other way and the alternative is the threat of serious civilian deaths here or elsewhere, to Muslims for that matter in the world, we've got to do it. Is he cut off from something now, Jack?
Well, you know, it was such an ambivalent speech. It reminded me really of that, that apothegm about St. Augustine in the brothel of Carthage, who said, "Stop me, O Lord, only not yet." And I agree with Major. What an intelligent speech. You know, the first moral obligation is to be intelligent, and this was that. He thought this through, and he showed a great deal of perhaps not as much as Major would want, but a great deal of self-reflection that was hardly mm-hmm. flattering. I mean, mm-hmm. he quoted really against the policies of his own administration, yes. James Madison saying no nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Well, look, just recently, I mean, of course, Guantanamo, the standing disgrace to American institutions, the traditions, that is, the killing of American citizens via drones, and then now this campaign by the Justice Department against news gathering organizations. All of these bear out on security grounds. All of these bear out the Madison warning, and all have either happened or been accentuated under President Obama. So he wanted to have it. It seemed to me both ways.
We all knew from the beginning he didn't want to have a global war on terror forever. Everybody could see how. I mean, it may have been even destructive in the short term, but the threat seems so real, but not forever. Here we have a president at least articulating that it needs to end. I wonder how this is going to go down politically. Senator John McCain responded right away after the speech yesterday to the president's suggestion that al-Qaeda is not as strong as it once was.
Al-Qaeda is on the run, expanding all over the Middle East, from Mali to Yemen and all places in between. And to somehow think that we can bring the authorization of the use of military force to a complete closure contradicts the reality of the facts on the ground. Al-Qaeda will be with us for a long time.
Another Republican saying, no, we just can't close Guantanamo. Meredith, how do you expect Republicans to receive the president's, not the ending of the war, but the call for an ending of the war?
Well, I think listening to what Jack and to what Major had said, it's too early to tell, from my perspective at least, whether or not the speech will be an actual inflection point in terms of action. Because, you know, listening to what Major was saying again, he said, you know, after 5 years of originally promising to close Guantanamo, that was 5 years ago, and it was one of his first promises. He said it was one of the first things he would do when he was in office. And so you have to remember the context for this speech. The context for the speech is that you have dozens, if not more than 100 now, prisoners at Guantanamo on hunger strike. You do have this huge story of the Department of Justice obtaining phone records of reporters, tracking reporters' entry in and out of State Department offices. I imagine an alternate universe in which this is a week in the news cycle for George W. Bush and what Nancy Pelosi might say to that. And so these are serious, serious things. And I can't remember a week in which we've talked more about the bounds of the administration in dealing with national security and where they should be able to go and where they shouldn't be able to go. And so to your question about Republicans, someone like John McCain is not going to want to let off the brakes in terms of pursuing al-Qaeda, in terms of what we're doing in Syria or in Libya. Remember, John McCain was one of the first people who really wanted to arm the Libyan rebels and who has talked about arming the Syrian rebels. The Senate yesterday passed a resolution, although it really didn't have actual policy teeth, supporting Israel in its stance against Iran. So these are all real issues that will face the president every day. And even if he wants to say these things, and he does believe these things about winding down the war on terror, the truth of the matter is that he's still the commander in chief, and everything that he would potentially want ideally isn't what ends up happening in practice. And I think that we've seen that in the first 4.5 years of his administration. Mm. And maybe he changes over the next 3 years, again, to sort of put the administration and our country on a different path than the one that he had inherited it on. But that's going to be a lot of hard work, particularly for a White House that, at least in my mind, for the past 4.5 years, has been very, very concerned about public opinion and about making sure that they look strong on these issues.
But rhetorically, intellectually, pulling away here, or at least trying to, it's going to be very interesting where this impulse goes. Jackie in West Hartford, Connecticut is calling in. Hi, Jackie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm calling because I wanted your comments and your panel's comments on what happened in London. I'm an immigrant from the Middle East, mm-hmm. and I can tell you firsthand that many of these governments are not open. They're not open to women. They're not open to the rights of minorities. It seems that in the UK and the US, there seems to be more and more homegrown terrorists and people who come here and who really don't share in the values of America and the West. And they're unapologetic for the violence that they bestow on their fellow citizens.
Jackie, let us pick that up, because that was a rough juxtaposition, the scene of that horrible, just a slaughter of the British soldier right there in the streets of London, outside the military base in London. By these guys with their knives and cleavers in hand, the blood of the dying soldier all over their hands as they talked about it. Talk about homegrown. Here is one of them. This was giving an impromptu video interview. This was Michael Abdebulajo, originally, I think, an immigrant from Nigeria, giving an interview to a passerby after the murder of the 25-year-old British soldier, drummer Lee Rigby.
By Allah, we swear by the Almighty Allah, we will never stop fighting you until you leave us alone. We must fight them as they fight us, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
We will never stop fighting you until you leave us alone. Fight them as they fight us, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, saying there's death in Islamic countries and we can't tolerate it and you're going to feel it here. British Prime Minister David Cameron spoke Thursday morning about the murder.
This was not just an attack on Britain and on the British way of life. It was also a betrayal of Islam and of the Muslim communities who give so much to our country. There is nothing in Islam that justifies this truly dreadful act.
Jack, it was truly dreadful. There's no question about that. And then the young man standing there with the knife and the blood dripping off his hands in the streets, making a speech to the video saying, look, we're bringing this to you. Our civilians have suffered, and now you will suffer.
And really, that's what Tsarnaev wrote on the boat. I mean, he wrote on the side of the boat just that. You know,
the younger
Muslims
brother
have suffered
in the Boston
abroad.
Bombing, yep.
Yes. Now you're going to suffer. And as in that case, where the FBI had looked into at least the older brother, there was some paper there. So in this case, MI5 has been looking at one of these men. I believe the one that you just quoted. For 8 years that they've been following him, and yet there he was. There he committed it. And here is another way in which Madison's fear about perpetual war can come home. How long are we going to go with, you know, the FBI, MI5, whatever it is, following these people without intervening? And if they intervene, do you have a kind of, you know, wait a minute, preventive detention here? You can't just intervene on the basis of nothing. On the other hand, if you just wait till the end and you have people killed, how is that a good use of resources? This is one of the ways in which terrorism begins to change the societies, change their legal structure.
Well, and I think this actually dovetails really well with what we were just discussing, because the collateral damage of the kind of policies we have, of these drone strikes, when we're going after particular people, but there are civilians who die with that, I mean, it's this cycle. If we are going to engage in this sorts of warfare, there will be consequences to that. But then when you listen to what David Cameron was saying about how this doesn't reflect on Islam, that's important too, because we have this response when these things happen that we profile and we stereotype, whether it's in the long-term discussions of these issues. Like, think back to Boston. You have the New York Post putting people on their cover who don't end up actually even being the suspects at all.
Well, you know, that was
and
as
so
bad as it gets.
We need to make a decision as a country that we aren't going to cast aspersions on entire groups of people because of isolated incidents. But I think it's difficult because of this media cycle we were even talking about when we're talking about Oklahoma. You see these images over and over again, and I think it plays to people and their visceral emotions.
I mean, we're talking about London right here, and I want to take it to Major, if I may, yeah. Meredith. Major, the president tried to speak to this in the speech yesterday.
He did. You know, if you look at the speech, the president said, we started this war because it came to us on 9/11, and there was a necessary application of force in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Then he, as he often has, and for goodness sake, built his presidential campaign, at least partially around, a decision to go into Iraq, which the president said then and said now again was a erroneous decision, a distracting decision. He said, but what we have to understand in the modern, contemporary application of terrorism, not a war on terrorism, but terrorism as it affects us, as it affects our psychology, as it affects our sense of civil liberties, as it affects our daily lives in Boston or London or anywhere else, it is pockets of extremism that can lay dormant and then become malevolent. And this is, if I could, Tom, a combination of modernity, barbarism, and civil liberties.
But you can't stop
in
a guy
the
with a knife
Tsarnaev
with drones.
Case, like in Boston, for example, Tamerlan Tsarnaev was on our list because the Russians said he was a Chechen extremist. And because he was a U.S. person, a green card, a permanent legal resident, we opened a file, meaning the FBI did, for 90 days looked into it, and then closed the file. And then people said, why did you close the file? Because we're a free society, and there was nothing indicating you were a threat. Same thing in London. And yet they both came back to prove harmful. That's something we have to cope with.
The president in his speech saying that the war on terror itself, if it goes on too long, can breed the kind of tensions that maybe bring us into this homegrown zone. On the other hand, there is the security threat right in the streets of London and before that in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news this week, a four-lane interstate bridge in Washington State on I-5 north of Seattle collapsed last night, sending cars into the river below. Survivor Dan Sly was on the bridge when it went down.
Forward momentum just carried us right over, and as you saw the water approaching, it's just one of those, you hold on as tight as you can, and just a white flash and cold water.
Disgraced former Congressman Anthony Weiner announced this week he is jumping into the race to be New York City's next mayor. New Yorker Gail Sorrell wasn't so sure about that.
I think he has some emotional problems when you display yourself like that. And I think if you're so indiscreet in your personal life, what are you going to be in your political life?
And 80-year-old Japanese mountain climber Yuichiro Miura is now the oldest person to have reached the top of Mount Everest. 80. He spoke with his family from the summit via satellite phone. Pretty amazing. We're looking at a week in the news. The big tornado, the Boy Scouts vote, the president's defense of drone strikes, Apple in the hot seat. Meredith Shiner is with us from CQ Roll Call out of Washington. Major Garrett is here, chief White House correspondent for CBS News, and our own Jack Beatty. Just one more on national security, and we'll move into IRS and all the rest. Greg in Buffalo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have 2 points. I think they're related, and I'd love to make them and have you and your guests respond.
Yeah.
The first, for me, at a very personal, emotional level, the idea that the war, quote-unquote, potentially is over, I find in some ways uplifting. As a 60-some-odd-year-old person, I thought my children and grandchildren would be forever involved in this war. And the second thing is, let's define war. I mean, what does that mean? Is sending a SEAL team in to capture a terrorist suspect in some other country to bring them back for interrogation and or trial, is that war? Or is war what we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan and Grenada and so forth and so on?
Yeah,
so,
Greg, I appreciate your call. If you'll permit me, I'm going to let that sentiment sit right there. We're going to have weeks, months, years to work on this. But that feeling of uplift that a president has articulated an end to it is maybe the most resonant thing in this week long term. And let us just sit with that for a second. I've got so much more news to turn to. I want to go right to the IRS. We saw Wednesday Lois Lerner, director of exempt organizations, pleading the Fifth to, instead of testifying really before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, about her role in the IRS's targeting of specific political groups. Here she goes.
While I would very much like to answer the committee's questions today, I've been advised by my counsel to assert my constitutional right not to testify or answer questions related to the subject matter of this hearing. After very careful consideration, I have decided to follow my counsel's advice and not testify or answer any of the questions today.
And there she was taking the Fifth, but not until after she had said she'd done nothing wrong. Meredith, on the congressional side, where does this leave the IRS story? Are we anywhere near finished with this? Is it going to go on forever?
Well, Daryl Issa was not pleased with the fact that she gave her opening statement and then pleaded the Fifth. He'd like to call her back. I don't think that he's going to be able to force her to talk. But as a larger political issue, no, I don't think that this issue is going to go away. I think, at least from a political perspective, it's good for Republicans right now because it looks like the administration in some capacity had targeted conservative groups. But as a larger policy issue, I think that this is much more challenging because you have a growing number of these political groups who are trying to file for these exemptions as 501c3s, and you have an IRS that is at worst incompetent and at best understaffed and underfunded. And you're hearing some of these Republicans who want to offer amendments even to a farm bill trying to siphon off funding from the IRS, because remember, the IRS is going to have a very significant hand in implementing some of the tax code changes involved with the Affordable Care Act. And so they want to take more funding away from the IRS, which I think probably will further cause problems because you're not going to have the kind of staffing capable of taking in all of these forms and looking at all of these applications. I mean, I think that part of the reason why you saw these groups targeted wasn't necessarily because it was nefarious in intent. It was because it was expedient in intent. And with the kind of people they had looking at these groups, that was an easy way for the for them to do it. In the grand scale of things, more conservative groups got approved for this particular exemption than progressive groups. I saw a report that said in 2012, only 7 groups with the name progressive or liberal or whatever those Q words are for those left groups were approved by the IRS. So it's not that in practice these groups weren't approved. It's just that they did go through a higher level of scrutiny. And so it's a question about our electoral system, too. Should the FEC be involved? I don't know, but legislatively now it's going to be much more difficult to get anything done in this regard.
You know, it wasn't just Republicans who were venting here. I mean, you had Democratic Congressman Stephen Lynch out of Massachusetts talking Wednesday at a hearing. Well, here he is. He was pretty head up.
If this committee is prevented by obstruction or by refusal to answer the questions that we need to get to the bottom of this, you will leave us no alternative but to ask for the appointment of a special prosecutor or appointment to special counsel to get to the bottom of this.
I don't know where the bottom of it is. I don't know where the top of it is. But Jack Beatty, here you go. It's sort of like Grover Norquist's dream. I mean, if you're going to mount, you know, take away funding from the IRS so you get into a downward spiral of efficacy to even bring in the revenue, never mind drowning the baby in the bathtub, you take away the bathtub.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And since the original problem seemed to be caused by a dearth of staffing in Cincinnati, I mean, the reporting had brought out that at one point and for some period, one person was handling all this flood of applications. One person. So imagine an even more, you know, straitened IRS. It'll be doing less regulation. And that's, I think, one of the real long-term mischiefs of this whole episode. You know, I mean, it does strike me that GOP indignation really is in excess of the evidence offered. I mean, it more one reads about it, the more it seems to have been, just as Meredith said, a kind of bureaucratic snafu and very, very stupid practice on the part of people, politically blind, tone deaf. But on the other hand, the way the White House has handled this, it's succession of well, we didn't know, but then somebody did know. And I want to turn to Major if I could on this. Major, does the White House have credibility on this subject, the way they keep changing their story?
Got pretty tense in the press room this week, Major.
Very tense in the press room, and an evolving story. And whenever there's an evolving story from the White House, those of us in the front row, second row, third row, front row, or fourth row every day of the briefing become ever more curious. Now, what we need to establish is the Inspector General's report on this was an audit. It was not an investigation. If the Inspector General or those working for the Inspector General asked people at the IRS, well, did you do this intentionally for political reasons? And they said no. They accepted those answers at face value. All right, this was not an investigation. It didn't have subpoena power. It didn't have any of the sort of larger intimidating powers that a criminal investigation now launched by the Justice Department in fact has, or that a special prosecutor would bring to the underlying questions of how did this get started? Whose idea was it? Why was this higher level of scrutiny? And yes, it may be bureaucratic, but I think Jack and Meredith would agree when you look at some of the questions that were put to these organizers of these very low-level grassroots Tea Party organizations, they were at minimum intrusive and at maximum, absolutely outrageous. You know, who are your members? Do they pray? Do they go to church? What are their email addresses? I mean, there was a kind of inordinate fascination and curiosity to this scrutiny that made these organizations that were just trying to get involved in the political process feel as if they were being scrutinized by the government in a way that might be felt as an intimidating process.
But it wasn't just to be involved politically, right? I mean, it was to be involved in a tax-exempt status. You can be involved without tax-exempt status.
Sure, you can. And you can talk about legislation. You can talk about the debt. You can talk about the deficit and retain your tax-exempt status. I mean, 501c4 categorization is broad. Yep. And if you're on 49% of the overall totality of your group dealing with legislation and public education, or 51%, you're fine. And finding that balance does require some scrutiny. But I think these groups felt that the level of questioning was, it, like I said, at minimum intrusive and in some respects beyond that.
Major, what about, you're in the White House, what about the this question of how high awareness of this went? Republicans pushing hard on that this week. What did the president know? When did he know it? And all that. Where does that go?
Now, the White House says, look, The president intended to be insulated by this. The president basically told his administration coming in, look, there are a lot of bureaucracies that we can touch. I've talked to very senior people at the White House who said, as an example, we completely redid the Federal Emergency Management Agency after the Bush era. We completely got into that bureaucracy and we changed it. Greg Fugate has been the only administrator under President Obama, and everything he does reflects exactly what the president wants to be done. We've gotten into that bureaucracy and we've changed it. The White House says, look, we are not, by practice, by precedent, and by politics, going to get involved in the IRS because we don't want headlines. We didn't want them in 2009, 2010, or ever. Obama remaking the IRS, because they knew that was toxic politically and they weren't going to get involved. So they've kept, as they tell me, arm's length from the IRS in a way that possibly now is injurious, because the word to everyone in the senior staff, White House counsel, everyone else, don't bring it to me. If it's about the IRS, I don't want to know. And that I don't want to know declaration is what Kathy Rummer, the White House counsel, and her staff first notified about this IG report, that there would be something very conspicuous to apologize for. A political firestorm was heading your way, Mr. President. Don't tell the commander-in-chief.
Well, and
I don't want to know. It's a pretty weird political stance, pretty weird leadership stance, but okay, Meredith?
There's no political upside for really anyone to defend the IRS. The IRS, what American likes the IRS? What American likes the organization that comes and collects taxes?
Well, yeah, so you're not people aren't fools. They know at the end of the day, if you want to have a country that runs, you're going to have to have revenue.
I agree. But right. From a political perspective, there isn't a lot of upside to defending this organization. But I think the central question is this. These 501c3s and 501c4s, the reason this tax exempt status was created was because these groups were supposed to be contributing to communities, either in some sort of religious, educational, charitable, social welfare kind of way. And I think it's fair to ask that question from an intellectual perspective. These political groups that are advocating for a particular policy position, what kind of social welfare are they providing to the community? If we're going to have this larger intellectual conversation, we should have it. But I don't think that we're going to, because of what has happened here, because it looks so slimy.
So hard to
that is one way to judge. That is one way to pick up on Jack's point, Tom. That is one way to judge the Republican outrage on the faux legitimate meter. Because if the Republicans are going to get engaged and say, look, 501c4s are a big mess, and perhaps the IRS isn't the agency that should deal with this. Perhaps we should put this at the Federal Election Commission or some other place, and we should actually establish more coherent rules of the road, and the House of Representatives is going to dedicate itself to writing coherent legislation that regularizes these rules and makes this a more coherent and logical process. If they do that in addition to their outrage, then the public can evaluate it. If it's only outrage, I think they can come to a different conclusion.
Meredith, very quickly, Meredith, we've got more to look at. If I may, Meredith.
No, neither am I.
Listen,
I just wanted to make that clear.
On the revenue side, Apple, very quickly, because we've got more to look at here and our time is short, but do you see Congress acting? You know, they brought Tim Cook in. They raked him over the coals for planting all these profits abroad and avoiding all those taxes. And it is a lot. And there's a trend here of American companies setting up shop abroad in Ireland or anywhere else where they don't have to pay taxes here. Do you see Congress moving to fix this, to change it?
The most interesting prism to look at this through is Rand Paul basically went after his colleagues in front of his colleagues saying, I can't believe we're bringing the CEO of this great company in and chastising him for just exploiting the rules as they are. This is ridiculous. It's counter-capitalism, whatever. The one point he made was that Congress should look in the mirror and look at the system that they've created. And I think that that's actually a point where Democrats and Republicans can agree. The tax code is a mess. It's going to be very difficult to change because you have all of these groups that lobby on behalf of their particular interests or industry.
But if you've got a generation of companies taking headquarters abroad through subsidiaries and planting profits there, I mean, I guess you've got to try and fix that up. But I'm reading, commentator after commentator saying this is pretty tough to do if companies are determined to plant themselves abroad. What do we do for revenue at home? I got to move from that to Boy Scouts because lots of people calling in on that. David in New Orleans. David, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Tom.
Yeah,
I have a comment on the move. And while I applaud the Boy Scouts for letting in gay scouts, I also believe that it's an organization that has major changes to make in the culture of accountability. And as a former Boy Scout myself, who faced discrimination, I believe that the rules and regulations from the home office that are that made their way to the regional offices never really make their way out to the individual troops, to the scoutmasters.
Accountability for what, David? Accountability for what?
Accountability to uphold these standards that they're implementing. So the standards to have an equal treatment, non-discrimination, lack of stigma, all of these types of protocols and policies that are in place at the national office aren't necessarily actualized in the Boy Scout troops when they're on the Boy Scout events.
Yeah, well, it's policy now, and we'll see how that rolls out. Dale in Nashville. Dale, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Big kudos today to the decision being made. I was a young Boy Scout. It was a very important time in my life. It instilled a great part of the leadership, and then being gay was not a part of my childhood. It was a great experience. I had a wonderful time, and as an adult, I think it was one of the best decisions I made to open that door, that to change the policy, because I think everyone deserves the right just to have the fellowship with our brothers. And being gay has nothing to do with it at all. So big kudos.
Dale, I appreciate your call. Jack, I mean, whatever you think of this, at one level, it's just great that they won't have to, it's just the members, the kids joining Boy Scouts, they don't have to think about what their sexual orientation is here. That's a kind of freedom in itself.
It is. It's a gain for decency and for human possibility. On the other hand, it's only up to age 18, and that's got to change. At age 18, if they want to be leaders, they can't be. That continues the stigma, and assuredly that will change in coming years.
Well, maybe. Culture and politics around that issue changing a lot in recent years, and now even in the Boy Scouts of America. Meredith Chiner with the CQ Roll Call, thank you very much for being with us today, Meredith. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News, making a lot of noise down there this week. Major, thank you for joining us on our Friday Roundup.
Tom, thank you. And to everyone, happy Memorial Day, or as it used to be known, Decoration Day.
Decoration Day, indeed. And Jack, thanks to you. Great weekend to everyone. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.